Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now we welcome Padma Desai, the renowned Columbia University economics professor, now in her 80s, on her life as an immigrant from India and a lifetime of watching socialism and capitalism. After a career writing books with titles like Financial Crisis, Contagion and Containment, and Conversations on Russia, Reform from Yeltsin to Putin, her new memoir is called Breaking Out, An Indian Woman's American Journey. So we will talk about life and politics from New York to New Delhi and economics from Khrushchev to Krugman. Dr. Desai, a privilege. Thank you for coming downtown to our studios.
I'm very happy to be here.
Is it fair to say that your memoir's title, Breaking Out, is about the classically liberating journey of a woman from a society where women have few choices to the United States, where you have more?
Absolutely. When I came to America as a youngster, 1955, almost 58 years ago, at Harvard, as a student, a graduate student on an American fellowship, I was there for 4 years, got my PhD in the economics department, and I found Harvard completely liberating, exhilarating, enlightening. And I like to think that my American roots are in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and my adrenaline flows high when I walk in Harvard Yard.
And yet we don't think these days of the 1950s in this country as being a time of opportunity for professional and academic women, no less an immigrant woman of color at an Ivy League school. Was there discrimination or dismissiveness that you found at all?
There was some. There were both. A lot of admiration and some discrimination. The discrimination arose from certain practices which I observed but didn't think about. I was a graduate student and I attended classes with Harvard graduate men, but we three women, we took our examination separately in a hall in Ratcliffe Yard. And it didn't occur to me to question this arrangement. At the same time, however, I got a lot of admiration. I was wearing a sari, I had a red dot on my forehead, and I attracted so much attention as an exotic being from the far side of the planet. And I could never get over these three guys, blonde-haired, blue-eyed men whom I had never seen, nor had they seen a woman like me, and our attraction was mutual. They were from the military in the United States on GI Bill, and they sat around me and lit our library talking about this and that, and finally ending the conversation saying, Padma, what are you doing here? You should be in Hollywood.
But these days, I think young women from places other than the United States would be offended, perhaps that's the word, by being viewed as exotic.
Absolutely. I think so. It didn't bother me, though. I got so much attraction when I crossed the street to Litauer Library. The truck drivers would shout at me from a distance. I wore a sari, and they would say, hey, lady, your slip is showing. What did that mean, that my sari didn't go far enough to the floor? And, of course, the children in Cambridge Common, they surrounded me and riding their bicycle. And when I said, can I ride your bicycle? They used to call me a gypsy woman. And I said, can I ride your bicycle? And they were completely astounded.
Mm-hmm. And the language you use about this feeling of liberation that you had coming to the United States from India in the 1950s, right on page one, is strong. Quote, I felt freer, less encumbered by countless traditional rules. My American world was less intrusive, and I was gradually stepping out of captivity. Is captivity the way you would describe life for women in India or for yourself at the time that you were living there prior to the 1950s?
In those days, certainly. I had an extremely sheltered and disciplined upbringing. My father had a degree from Cambridge University in English Literature in 1925, 1927. But of course, he was a traditional father, and he thought of me as someone who had to be married off, whereas I wanted to have academic fulfillment, reach out for the stars, and go to Harvard. And so growing up, I felt like a fish swimming upstream. And that was a problem. But my father gave me rules of behavior with friends, with people around me, which I still value.
And that was from a father who was educated, an English literature professor, and from a, if I'm not mistaken, privileged Brahmin caste in India. Was it that much more captivity for women with less?
Well, there were certain traditional rules in the Anavil Brahmin caste in which I to which I belonged, and in that caste, the bride's father had to pay a dowry to the bridegroom's family. Also, if brides didn't bring enough dowry, then they could be gotten rid of. And if women became widows, they would burn themselves. A close cousin of my father, when he died, his wife shut herself in the lavatory and burned herself. And my father and mother were around at that time. So, but that was years ago. The dowry still pervades, although dowry is prohibited by Indian law.
I'd say the most pervasive news story that we've heard in this country in the last 2 years about women in India was about that gang rape in New Delhi last year. Do we miss progress that's being made?
Well, I think the India is such a complicated scene. Much of the country, up to 60% of the people, live in the rural areas, and their women's situation is sort of very discriminated against and underprivileged and all that. In the urban areas, women have made some progress. After all, India had a woman prime minister, Mrs. Indira Gandhi. But despite that, while women have made progress in offices, in the corporate sector, and in public life in the urban areas, the culture is hierarchical, I think, and also patriarchal.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with the renowned Columbia University economics professor, Padma Desai. Her new memoir is Breaking Out, An Indian Woman's American Journey. And we can take phone calls for her if we have time. President Obama will speak at some point to announce this change in Obamacare based on the problems that they've been having with people losing their prior insurance. We don't know exactly when that'll come. It's scheduled for about 10 minutes from now. He's often late. So we may have time for calls for Padma Desai if you want to call in and get in line for that. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We'll get into some of her economics. She's had, as a Russia expert and global economy expert, the, I think, privilege of watching the old Soviet system break down and been able to follow the emergence of new economics around the world for better, worse, and mixed over the last 25 years. We'll get into some of that. But I think, Dr. Desai, that one of the most interesting and unusual stories in your book is that you converted from Hinduism to Christianity as a means of escaping your first marriage, and you refer to it as the sole spiritual experience of your life. How did converting to Christianity help you out of your marriage?
Well, actually, it didn't. The Hindu Code Bill of 1955 allowed that a sacramental marriage can be dissolved if one party converts to another religion and and if the other party agrees. So my former husband, his family informed our lawyer saying that if she converts to Christianity, we will grant her a divorce. But when I converted to Christianity, he said, I have changed my mind. So it was a bit of a trap. I still feel that my conversion in a dirt poor Indian village, in a poor church with a leaky roof on a rainy day, among the poorest of the poor in India.
In what year?
It was probably in the late 1960s. I do not remember the name of the village nor of the pastor. But he took us to his poor home, gave us some dal and rice, and I was thinking of where is the wine and where is the bread which Christ talks about. And then we went to the church, and he just sprinkled some drops of water on my hand and said, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, I pronounce you a Christian. And I was with my brother. It was raining outside, and these poor people in front of me and this pastor who converted me to Christianity so that I could liberate myself, the whole environment and his generosity, it is as a result of that that I regard it as the only spiritual experience of my life, and I have never wanted to become a Hindu again.
Is it accurate to say it was a sham conversion for utilitarian purposes to get out of your marriage, and then you were surprised by how spiritual an experience it was?
Yes. I mean, it was a way out, a practical way out, so far as I was concerned. And my parents, they were so eager for me to get liberated and get settled again that they also agreed. So it was a practical decision, and they also agreed.
But if it was such a spiritual experience, why didn't you continue to practice as a Christian and have more spiritual experiences?
Well, now that I'm on the verge of retirement, I'm planning to go to the cathedral and spend my time listening to the services in the cathedral.
Padma Desai, author of her memoir, Breaking Out, An Indian Woman's American Journey. You taught at Columbia for more than 30 years?
That's right, 32 years.
Just retired a few years ago.
I'm going to retire.
Oh, going to retire.
In July.
I'm sorry. And you're right about seeing each year's freshmen as representing this country's ever-changing makeup and its youth and impatience. What would be a big change that you saw over three decades in the incoming freshmen? Did their attitudes toward themselves and the world change over time?
I think what I found very impressive about American youth, I mean, I started teaching at Harvard in 1957 to the Harvard undergraduate class, is their idealism. I think American young, whom I have met, are idealistic. And in one of my classes, the last classes to Columbia freshmen, I said, go out, you know, live among the poorest of the poor who live for a dollar a day, come back. Maybe you will join Wall Street, make your millions, and give some of your earned money to Columbia College. That was my message to them. But I do find the idealism. But what I find somewhat disturbing today, in contrast to my earlier experience as a teacher, is the presence of computers in the classroom. And when half the class in a class of, say, 60 undergraduates have computers, I don't know what they are doing. Are they taking notes from my lecture, or are they watching videos? And that is disturbing.
So I don't know how much time we have before the president starts. Sometimes he's on time. Sometimes he's a half hour late. Sometimes in between. So let me ask you about your life's work as an expert on the global economy, financial crises, Russia, and more. 10 years ago, you published a book called Financial Crisis, Contagion, and Containment from Asia to Argentina. And it included how Russia and Brazil were hurt by the international financial crisis of the late 90s, early 2000s. But since then, they've become the new lions of recent years. We talk with envy in this country about the BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, though that may be fading now too. But did it surprise you when they became the world's growth engines?
Well, it was really a marvelous experience in these countries' lives and economic policy making and their economic betterment. The years 2000 to 2007, before the financial crisis hit the world economy, starting from the United States in 2008, from 2000 to 2007, these countries were doing very well, prospering. Their growth rates were very high. Some of them were export-oriented, like China, who was a major exporter in the world economy. And Russia, under Vladimir Putin, it was an oil-based recovery. Oil prices were moving up, and so Russian economy prospered. So did Brazil, which exports lots of raw materials. And so these economies were doing very well. But after the crisis hit in early, mid-2008, these economies are in a bad shape. Even China now is... we expect it to grow at a little over 7% GDP real growth rate, and none of that 10% growth rate of the early years.
You've had the good fortune to become a Russia expert in the 50s and 60s, then get to watch the fall of communism through expert eyes. It's 25 years ago now, and we take it for granted. But did you ever think you would see it in your lifetime?
No, I didn't. I became a Soviet Russian expert because of my love for Russian literature. I read Dostoevsky as a teenager in India, English translation of Crime and Punishment by Constance Garnett. And I said, my God, I have to read this book in the Russian language. So when I went to Harvard as a graduate student in the 50s, I also registered in the Slavic department and started learning Russian. And it is my second favorite language, its musicality, its grammar, its complexity after Sanskrit. And so the transition to Soviet Russian economies was from Russian literature. But I'm happy that I studied the Soviet economy. I lived there as early as 1964 in the summer. And I tell my Russian friends, your leader, Dmitry Medvedev, who is now the prime minister, was born in 1965. But I'm 1 year ahead of him.
Well, despite the deadening totalitarianism of Soviet communism, does the average Russian feel better off today?
I think the years from 2000 to 2007 under Vladimir Putin brought quite a bit of prosperity to the Russians. There are more cars, more homes, more apartments. The communist system, in the sense of the government as employee of workers, men, women, is now practically gone. But the system doesn't operate as a full-fledged market economy. There is a predominant presence of large state-owned enterprises, especially in the oil and natural resources sector, and they need to open it up to foreign investors.
Did you happened to hear our discussion with the previous guest of the recent Pew poll of young Democrats in the United States, young Americans who identify with the Democratic Party, that they view, on average, socialism more favorably than capitalism when asked just those two words to compare? Does that surprise you?
Yes, it does. It does surprise me. I have lived in America for 50 years. I'm in love with this country. And the one aspect of America which I find very encouraging and enlightening is the private initiative, private enterprise, the self-reliance also, and individualism, and at the same time, the desire for government's role, especially the desire of the Democratic Party to continue with some of the entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, which benefit, I like to think, the poor. So I like the American arrangement of, private effort, private enterprise, doing one's best, fulfilling one's role in life, and at the same time giving something back to the community. What can I give back to the community, I find, is a very special American call.
But today, inequality is so much on American minds and New Yorkers' minds, with the election of Bill de Blasio reflecting that. Do you see, with all your experience in global economics, the United States as becoming more of, I don't know what the word would be, I don't know if it's oligarchy or, a Latin American-style rich and poor economy?
Well, that is going to be the big problem for the policymakers in the country under the presidency, second presidency of President Obama, the reduction of inequality, the reformulation of the entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, which help alleviate some of this poverty. I think we need to restructure them sensibly.
Before you go, we should mention in relation to your memoir that your second marriage has now lasted more than 40 years to another – is 40 the right number? – to another renowned economist, Jagdish Bhagwati, who has been a guest on this show and in his own right. And he has this beautiful quote in your book when he's wooing you in 1963, offering you, quote, "not a blaze of love, but a lantern glimmer of the same." And that's so unusual for a love letter, to pull back on the intensity rather than put it out there in a blaze. Can you reflect on the context of that?
Well, it's a very long relationship, Jagdish and I. We met in 1956 when he was a graduate student at MIT and I was a graduate student at Harvard. So we met at a student association get-together, and he fell in love with me right away. I was beautiful, and I was serving his favorite food. So it has lasted all these years, but he's brilliant. He's devoted. He's my companion of over 50 years. The quotation I make in the book is quoting Werner Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, that is to say, the particle in that uncertainty principle. You can determine its velocity or its location, but not both. That's my husband. You can determine his velocity, where he is going at a given moment, or his location, but not both.
The first time a guest on this show has used Heisenberg's uncertainty principle to refer to a spouse. And with that, we thank Padma Desai, the renowned Columbia University economics professor. Her new memoir is called Breaking Out, An Indian Woman's American Journey. Thank you so much. It's been a privilege.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Nels Klein, the guitarist for Wilco, on advancing music education. And we'll see when President Obama starts his announcement on changes that we are expecting him to announce to Obamacare. Stay with us.